Zain enters the city of Sham, and Imam Zain al-Abidin climbs the pulpit. For the first time, he addresses himself as to who he really is. The people of Syria begin to realize what a mistake they have made. Understand, this was Muawiyah.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The Marvel film franchise has attracted widespread criticism over its upcoming movie, Captain America: New World Order, because it features a character who's portrayed as a former Mossad operative. In this week's show, we'll be delving into the Marvel controversy and we'll look more broadly at Zionist influence in Hollywood. I'll be speaking to experts to find out more after this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra on the dissension Marvel's forthcoming film has generated.
A controversy has emerged around the Hollywood juggernaut Marvel Studios as it was announced that its forthcoming film, Captain America 4, would feature the character of an Israeli intelligence agent named Sabra. This has raised concerns not only about Marvel's own historical ties to the Israeli military, but also about the Zionist regime's broader influence in Hollywood. The actor scheduled to play the Sabra character, Shira Haas, originally learnt to act in the Israeli military, where she was part of a theatre group. She also worked with Stand With Us, an Israel lobby group funded directly by the Israeli Prime Minister's office. Stand With Us also founded a cultural arm focused on the music and film industry called Creative Community for Peace, formed by music and film executives to pressure artists and actors to normalize with Israel and shun BDS. Shira Haas is also due to appear in a series called Lioness, playing the character of Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir and depicting her life in an attempt to beautify her legacy. Marvel has a long history of collaborating with the US military, allowing it to edit scripts for films such as Captain America, First America, Iron Man 1 and 2, The Hulk, and Captain America, amongst many others. What is less known is the extent to which Israeli military figures linked to significant lobby groups have had a role in the company's story. The current chairman of Marvel Entertainment is Isaac Perlmutter. He fought in the Israeli military, occupying the West Bank and Gaza. His family foundation funds the Friends of Israel Occupation Forces, the ADL, and the Jewish Agency for Israel. Perlmutter is also very close to Donald Trump and was often referred to as the shadow of the head of military veterans affairs due to the close advisory role he fulfilled while Trump was president. His wife, Laura Perlmutter, funded Trump's election campaign and was even on his inauguration committee. Avi Arad, current CEO of Marvel Entertainment, also fought in the Israeli military at the same time. Early investors in Marvel Comics, Carl Ishan and Ronald Perelman, are also linked very closely to Israel. Both were included in Benjamin Netanyahu's infamous list of millionaires to be tapped up to fund his election campaign. Perelman's foundation has contributed to several prominent Zionist organizations, including the JNF, which is the largest settlement building organization in Palestine. Perelman is thought to be very close to Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and has a history of donating to Trump's election campaigns. Perelman is also believed to have been close to convicted pedophile, sex trafficker, and likely Israel intelligence asset, Jeffrey Epstein.
I love Donald. I've known Donald for 30 years. I would consider him a good friend of mine. I know his kids. He's got great kids, I think. I think that is one real indication of the man, is to look at the kids that he's raised. And that would show, you know, a great strength and a sense of character that he's got. He does like to talk.
So here we have some background on Marvel and how it could come to glorify Israeli intelligence agents before millions of impressionable young minds.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David co-founded and he is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Matt Alford, who joins us from Devon. Matt's an academic and a filmmaker. He's written widely on Hollywood and how it's used for propaganda purposes. His first documentary feature film was the award-winning The Writer with No Hands, which examined a conspiracy theory about the death of a Hollywood screenwriter. Matt's latest documentary, Theatres of War, is based on his co-authored book, National Security Cinema, The Shocking New Evidence of Government Control in Hollywood, that draws on archives and interview-gathering trips to Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show. David, what do you know about this Sabra character then?
Well, this is a character which has been in Marvel Comics for some considerable time, but this is the first time that she's been in a film, which is still to come out. And it's a Mossad operative, former Mossad operative. It's said that in response to the criticism that there's been over this, that they've rode back a little bit on the representation, and they're now supposed to be showing she is drawn by one of the other superheroes to see the effects of Israeli aggression on a Palestinian child. And this makes her more thoughtful about the human rights abuses that might be carried out by the Zionists. Mm. So there's an attempt to sort of soften the image of the Mossad superhero, if you like, and to show that there are some criticisms permissible of the Zionist state, but only some. And that, of course, is the point here.
Yeah. I mean, Matt, I mean, are these connections between Marvel and Israel significant, do you think? And what do you make of it?
Well, I certainly know that the connection between the Department of Defense and the CIA and Marvel are significant. I'm less knowledgeable about the links with Israel. But you've got to remember that the United States is such a massive industrial entertainment juggernaut that it dwarfs any other nation's ability to control media. And that's particularly the Department of Defense, which can rewrite scripts extensively and has done. The one of the headline findings that we've had is that, you know, there are perhaps 10,000 different products that have been affected over the past century, but with a huge escalation over the past 25 years in terms of cooperation with the U.S. military industrial complex. If you also include organizations like the FBI. It's really quite a shocking amount of control that is exercised by the American security state.
Interesting. Well, tell us a bit more about the relationship then between the United States military and Hollywood.
Well, the US military has quite a lot of power over Hollywood producers because they can offer things like aircraft carriers and Black Hawk helicopters and a lot of advice and just long-standing links in all sorts of different ways. So that they can exercise leverage over many, many scripts. And this happens, as you've already stated in your report, this happens on a lot of the Marvel films, but also over things like Transformers and basically almost any film that you ever see the military in the script has been combed through by the US military. It also often happens with the CIA as well, although to a much lesser extent, but still on very prominent products, such as the film depicting the search for Osama bin Laden, for example. And then there are other films as well, which may not have actually had Department of Defense or CIA or FBI support, but nevertheless still, and these are in some ways perhaps the most interesting films of all, films that haven't actually had script rewrites, but are still ideologically aligned to state interest. And it's interesting when that happens. I mean, in the case of representations of Israel, an interesting one from many years ago is the Spielberg film Munich in 2005, which did something, I guess, similar to what David's talking about in this new Marvel film, which I've not yet seen, so I won't comment on in any great detail. Yeah. But Munich did something similar in that it was softening Israel's image by by showing the humanity of the people who were involved in an assassination program against Palestinians. Now, does that, you know, how you want to interpret that as a political product is up to you. But it's certainly, if you are humanizing people who are doing illegal things, in the same way as if you are humanizing American soldiers in Vietnam, you take that as you will.
Yes. Yes. I mean, David, I mean, I guess the collaboration between the United States military and Hollywood isn't overly surprising, really. But, I mean, what about the way in which the Israeli military is depicted by Hollywood?
Well, I mean, I think you've got to look at this in the round. Of course, what everyone says is that the U.S. is the greatest ally of Israel, that Israel is sort of the lapdog or the Middle Eastern watchdog of U.S. imperialism. And, of course, when it comes to the representation of the military, then you'll see the kind of input made by the Department of Defense also having an effect on allied military. So, you know, the U.S. is the leading force in NATO, so British Army and other NATO forces will be more positively represented as a result of those kinds of influences. But the Israeli military, of course, is not widely seen outside Israel as being an overly abusive force. And in terms of the way in which they're represented in films, you don't have much of the way of those representations. But you can see that the way in which, for example, Israeli series, television series, which represent, for example, the CIA, are imported into the West. And there are attempts there to show a kind of a humanized, sanitized version of what the Israelis are up to.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, though, isn't it, that Marvel produced films like Black Panther, didn't they? Actively aimed at the black community in the US, and yet they've got strong links with Donald Trump within the company. It's a curious sort of comparison there.
Yes, I mean, it's a kind of moderate attempt to bring in a black audience while at the same time not really properly representing either organizations like the Black Panthers or liberation movements in the Global South. So yeah, it's a sort of calming down of the edges and an attempt to say that actually there's an audience here.
I mean, Matt, I mean, has Hollywood produced many other films that overtly promote intelligence agencies from other countries?
Mainly, I mean, the James Bond series obviously leaps to mind because the MI5 and the Department of Defense has been involved in that series. And that, again, wasn't really known until the 21st century. But they've been involved in at least half of the Bond films, which has involved script rewrites. They did for instance, they threw out a joke in one of the Bond films about the US losing the Vietnam War, for example. And they also changed the identity of one of the kidnapped admirals to make sure that he wasn't American. They think they made him Russian in the end so that it didn't reflect badly on them. So there's all sorts of promotion of American institutions and by implication and by extension sometimes also MI5. I don't think it happened. I mean, I think American filmmaking, the politicization of American filmmaking tends to be very American, if you like. I mean, they're not really looking to, promote the intelligence agencies of Britain directly or of the French or anything like that. But it tends to be very much more in-house about the representation of the CIA and Department of Defense. And part of the reason for that is that it's not just about propaganda in the normal sense. And it's not just about promoting an American view of history. It's also about recruitment. They want to recruit people for the US military and also for the CIA. In fact, one of the reasons that they got involved, the CIA in particular, got involved in filmmaking was because they were underrepresented in terms of diversity, particularly in terms of women, for example, in the 1990s. So they needed to get into that. And that's why they did series with people like actresses, stars like Jennifer Garner to make products like Alias. And that was to promote women into the agency. So it's more about the American experience. That,
yes.
At least from my research, more about the American experience.
OK. Well, thanks a lot, Matt. Let's just pause there for a moment and have a look at this report on how a cache of leaked Sony emails offer a revealing insight into Zionist influence on Hollywood.
The relationship between Israel and key Hollywood figures was blown open by the WikiLeaks exposure of emails belonging to Sony employees. A litany of lobbying activities was revealed being organized through official company emails. At that time, the Sony Pictures Entertainment CEO, Michael Linton, was revealed to be having dinner with then-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the invitation of famous film producer and Israeli spy Aaron Milchan. Films like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, 12 Years a Slave, Fight Club and Big Mama's House are some of Milchan's best-known works. He has publicly admitted running 30 different companies in 17 countries for Israeli intelligence.
Milchan detailed how he was recruited in the 1960s to Israel's Bureau of Scientific Relations, where he helped gather technology to further Israel's still unacknowledged nuclear program, saying, quote, "I did it for my country and I'm proud of it." Milchan moved to Hollywood in the 1970s, but he suggested his efforts on behalf of the Israeli government didn't end completely. Milchan indicated other big Hollywood players were also involved, saying, quote, "When I came to Hollywood, I detached myself completely from my physical activities to dedicate myself to what I really wanted, filmmaking. But sometimes it gets mixed up."
Former Israeli President Shimon Peres says of Aaron Milchan, "Aaron is a special man. It was I who recruited him. When I was at the Ministry of Defense, Aaron was involved in numerous defense-related procurement activities and intelligence operations. His strength is in making connections at the highest levels. His activities gave us a huge advantage, strategically, diplomatically, and technologically." Following his warm meeting with Netanyahu, Michael Linton went on to become the chairman of Snapchat and then Warner Music Group. The emails also reveal a campaign to get legendary British filmmaker Ken Loach banned from the Cannes Film Festival by pro-Israel film producers. Ben Silverman, former co-chairman of NBC Entertainment and Universal Media Studios, and producer of shows such as The Office, argued that Hollywood must boycott Loach for his pro-Palestinian views. Ron Rothals, producer of well-known hip-hop film classics like Paid in Full and State Property, rages in an email to the head of Cannes Festival that there's no place for Loach's intolerant and hateful remarks in a global world of film and filmmakers. The campaign against Loach was led by Ryan Kavanagh, CEO of Relativity Media, a company responsible for financing more than 200 movies, who acknowledges meeting with officials at the Israeli embassy to discuss the issue. Perhaps the worst aspect of the emails is the mobilization that takes place to support Israel when it bombed Gaza, killing around 2,400 people in 2014. It included hip-hop legend Russell Simmons asserting that he will begin lobbying for Israel, and the email checks former Israeli commander Kobi Marom inserted into it to assist the rich and famous in their efforts to support Israel.
David, what about the content of those Sony emails that WikiLeaks revealed? Quite interesting, isn't it?
It's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, when you see attacks on people for alleged anti-Semitism, you often imagine, you know, there must be people behind the scenes talking to each other, but you don't usually get the emails, you don't usually have the leaks. In this case, you have the leaks, you have the email chains with them discussing how to sabotage the possibility of Ken Loach being given an award. I mean, it's really extraordinary. These are people who are not Israel lobbyists, they're not people who are directly members of Israel lobby groups, but they are people who have contacts. There are people with connections to the Israeli intelligence services. There are people who are ideologically aligned, yes, and they speak to each other and they plan and they plot and they get together through emails. And these emails are the evidence of that, that's what they do. This is not something which is made up as a Jewish conspiracy. These are Zionist supporters who collaborate together, and the evidence is in this email cache. And it's really quite instructive to see how that works. And of course, that must be the way it works in many other cases too.
Yes. I mean, Matt, this character, Michael Linton, who was mentioned there, is also on the board of the Rand Corporation, which is a US military think tank. So what do you make of his meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, I certainly know that the Rand Corporation has also actually been involved in filmmaking before, including the Hollywood blockbuster film Red Dawn, which was about the Soviet invasion of the United States. That was a 1984 film, but then it was remade in 2012 with the Chinese being the villains, Chinese and North Koreans being the villains. So Rand has also been involved in filmmaking, has guided those kind of narratives. So I think that's probably quite instructive for the for what kind of meetings they would have been. It's interesting about Ken Loach. I mean, Ken Loach is about the least hateful person I can think of. He's a very gentle old soul. I often see him down at Bath train station. I've met him and interviewed him briefly at Bath Football Club. He makes all of these, you know, peace-nicked films. He really should not be the subject of that of those kind of attacks. He's a voice for peace.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, I've met Ken well, and a lovely guy, and certainly doesn't deserve the opprobrium which has been poured all over him. But David, I mean, what's your opinion of Arnon Milchan and his activity for Israel?
Well, again, here's another example of someone who is recruited for the Israeli intelligence services for a very obscure intelligence agency, which is mentioned there, that Bureau of Scientific Services, and who conducts many 30 different operations or 30 different companies he said he was involved in, and then who goes off to do something else, in this case filmmaking. And he says, but of course, you know, when I was doing filmmaking, the intelligence stuff got a little bit mixed up with that. So the people who are ex-Mossad or ex-Unit 8200, the Signals Intelligence Agency, they're not really always ex. Sometimes they go on and do other stuff because they've got the contacts.
Yes.
And they're perfectly happy in many circumstances to pass on information, to be part of networks, and to have an influence beyond their involvement technically in the intelligence agencies. Now, we've seen in this program many, many occasions when there are people who've been involved previously in the Israel Defense Forces, the Israeli military, or in their Israeli intelligence firms, companies, and raise the question about whether this is an issue. Well, we know from the Sony case, these are certainly issues.
No, indeed. I mean, Matt, the campaign against Ken Loach that you mentioned there, was ferocious, but ultimately it was unsuccessful. I mean, why do you think that was? Because since then, he was expelled from the Labour Party for refusing to denounce people like David and me, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's always a struggle, isn't there? And ultimately, the truth can out. And people like Ken Loach have had a lot of have got a strong constituency of, and also a strong middle class constituency, which, you know, is the English middle class is a useful bunch of people to be backing you, I guess. And also, he's been working since the 1960s. You know, his first film being Pez. You know, award-winning film, and then a whole series of products. And he's not just a political figure; he is also a cultural figure. So I think that helped. He is part of civilized society and has been a major part of people's lives. So it's an indication that these kind of fights can be won.
No, indeed, and I mean, of course, and that's encouraging. That you know, they're not all powerful, and you know, it's good to see that you know Ken was able to prevail in those circumstances. But finally, David, I mean, I see that the music mogul, Russell Simmons, is hoping to lobby for Israel. I mean, what else do we know about the Israel lobby's activities in the music industry?
Well, we've touched on the Zionist influence in Hollywood today. And earlier in the show, we mentioned the Creative Community for Peace, an organization set up by the Israel Lobby Group staff for us, which is involved in the creative community, which means, yes, the film industry and the media industry, and indeed the music industry. In previous shows, we've also looked a little bit at the music industry and the involvement of the Zionists in the music industry. And it's extremely strong influence there, because that many of the big music companies are run by Zionists. Mm. And it's an extraordinary thing to say, but they then are engaged directly in things like the Creative Community for Peace, or indirectly They have foundations which fund the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, the Jewish National Fund, and all sorts of other organizations which are involved in ethnic cleansing in Palestine. So these are significant issues in all the way through the entertainment industry, not just in relation to music and not just in relation to hip-hop.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because we are out of time again. And I'd just like to thank David, obviously, as our resident expert for joining us today, and obviously Matt joining us from Devon. Thank you for joining us as well today. And we'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
No doubt, Palestinians are the only owners of the land of Palestine, which is partly occupied by the fabricated regime of Israel. The Zionist regime, which is after ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, is now working to expel Palestinians from Masafer Yatah in the West Bank by making living conditions for its residents intolerable. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Electronic Intifada wrote, a prominent Israeli human rights group is calling on Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, to urgently intervene to prevent the expulsion of Palestinians from a rural area of the West Bank. In a letter delivered recently, Betzlem requested Khan's urgent intervention to prevent the Zionist regime from continuing to carry out this policy, and to clarify that forcible transfer constitutes a war crime under the Rome Statute, the founding treaty of the International Criminal Court. The Zionist regime seeks to expel some 1,000 Palestinians from Masafer Yatah in the West Bank's South Al-Khalil Hills by making the conditions they live in so unbearable they are forced to leave the area they have lived in for generations, Betzlem states in his letter. While these efforts have been underway for decades, the Zionist regime has recently massively stepped them up in scope, severity, and frequency. Those efforts were accelerated after the Zionist regime's high court rejected a legal challenge to the plans to turn the area into the military training zone. One of the Israeli regime judges who issued the verdict is a settler who was born in the UK and lives in a Jewish-only colony in the West Bank built in violation of international law. Ariel Sharon, then Zionist regime's agriculture minister, admitted in 1981 that the area was declared a firing zone for the purpose of displacing Palestinians from their land so it may be seized by the Israeli regime. The High Court's ruling in May concluded 2 decades of challenges mounted by Palestinians in Masafer Yatah. Since 2006, the fabricated regime of Israel destroyed nearly 70 residential structures in these communities that were home to 355 people, 175 of the miners, according to Betzalem. The group has also documented the demolition of 32 non-residential structures in these communities. Violence by Jewish settlers also serves the regime's aim of pushing Palestinians off their land in Masafer Yatta. Betzalem states, Jewish settlers physically assault Palestinian shepherds and use their land, sabotage water sources and enter homes, among other violent acts, with full state backing and often active participation of Israeli soldiers and police. According to Betzalem, since the High Court ruling earlier this year, life for Palestinian residents has become a nightmare. The Zionist regime's aim, the rights group says, is to make Palestinian lives miserable enough. So they will leave their homes and land, and the state will take over the area. The Zionist regime has conducted military training exercises involving tanks and live fire in the area. The military has confiscated vehicles and imposed roadblocks hindering Palestinians in the rural area from accessing nearby population centers. Betzalem said soldiers at roadblocks make it difficult and often outright prevent access to humanitarian agencies, human rights organizations, activists, journalists, and diplomats. An intervention by Khan's predecessor, Fatou Bensouda, is believed to have discouraged the Zionist regime from destroying Khan al-Ahmar, a Bedouin community in the West Bank. Bensouda warned the Zionist regime in 2018 that the planned eviction of Khan al-Ahmar would constitute a war crime. Despite this warning, several lawmakers pledged to destroy the village while campaigning for votes during the Zionist regime's last general election. Before her term as ICC chief prosecutor ended last year, Bensouda opened a formal investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip amid fierce opposition and hostility from the Zionist regime and the U.S. Israel's settlement enterprise in the West Bank is likely a primary focus of the ICC investigation. The Israeli regime's officials responsible for executing policy in Masafer Yatta may be treated as suspects by the court, which tries individuals rather than states. According to Betzalem, those responsible include Israeli regime's prime minister, war minister, military chief of staff, and the high court judges who legally sanctioned the policy. Even though the ICC opened an investigation in Palestine last year, international justice remains an uphill battle. Palestinian human rights groups have expressed frustration that since the beginning of his term as chief prosecutor last June, Khan, Britain's nominee for the post, the ICC investigation in Palestine, hasn't moved forward. The chief prosecutor, who was nominated for his post by the UK, which also opposes the ICC investigation in Palestine, has made no public statement according to Israeli regime recently banning and raiding offices of Palestinian human rights groups that have submitted evidence files to the court on behalf of victims. During his visit to Al-Quds in July, U.S. President Joe Biden affirmed that Washington would work with Tel Aviv to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israel, to deny its right to self-defense, or to unfairly single it out in any forum, including at the United Nations or International Criminal Court, Biden claimed. Also, the website of Palestine Chronicle wrote, Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has called on the International Criminal Court ICC prosecutor Karim Khan to urgently intervene to stop Israel from evicting Palestinians from their homes and land in Masafer Yatam, the official Palestinian news agency Wafa reported. Israeli regime authorities are planning the eviction of some 1,000 Palestinian inhabitants of Masafer Yatam, a rural area located south of Al-Khalil in the occupied West Bank, in order to create a military firing zone for Israeli regime occupation forces. 8 villages, including 4 schools, clinics, and hundreds of other structures in the area, are slated for demolition. The fabricated regime of Israel has been trying to drive these communities out for decades, but has recently escalated its actions in scope, severity, and frequency following the May 2022 ruling by the Zionist regime Supreme Court. The ruling, which contravened international law provisions and basic moral principles, reached the conclusion that the residents have no right to live on the land and there is no legal impediment to expelling them. Israel has made the residents' lives a nightmare. They suffer daily threats by soldiers and settlers to their bodies and property, as well as noise and pollution hazards, routine damage to infrastructure, incessant invasion of their privacy, and constant uncertainty over their future, said B'Tselem in a statement. The statement added, Israel is also working to cut these small communities off from their surroundings, with the military placing roadblocks, confiscating cars, and hindering activists, journalists, and diplomats from accessing the area.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini Islam, Dini, wal azam ghayru Dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to deal with an important subject of hijab according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But let's listen to a short biography before we start our program.
Mm-hmm.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasis, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for having me on this program.
You're welcome. Well, we are happy to have you back in the studio again. Would you shed some light for our dear audience about the meaning of hijab first, before we endeavor this program?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, hijab is an Arabic word meaning barrier or partition. Literally speaking, it means barrier. In Islam, hijab is not about barrier only.
It's so what's it about?
Yeah, it has a broader meaning, and it has something to do with the principles of modesty. And it is, in fact, the principle of modesty itself, because hijab is modesty. So because it includes the individual's behavior as well as the individual's dress.
Dress
and
code?
Of course, dress code. And the hijab is not only for men, for women only. It is both for men and women. And obviously, it's not only women who are supposed to observe the hijab, and of course, men are also supposed to observe the kind of modesty that are required, that they should. There are some standards of modesty for men also, and these standards must be observed by men as well. Now, the most visible form of hijab, obviously, is the head covering that many Muslim women wear. And when we talk about hijab, usually people are reminded of the scarf women wear. That is one of the the most visible form of hijab. And hijab, as I said, goes beyond the headscarf. In a religious context, actually, hijab is used as an expression to convey an act of covering all parts of the body except the face and the hands. We know very well, because we have of course discussed this issue in the past as well.
Yes,
that women are not are supposed to cover all parts of their body except the hands and except the face and the hands up to the wrists. That's what the Islamic...
But not the feet.
Yeah, of course, the feet should be covered.
Mm-hmm.
The feet should be covered. Not in during prayers, because if you are praying, if a woman is praying, obviously, she is not supposed to cover her feet when there is no one seeing her, when there is no non-mahram or marriageable man nearby to see her without socks without something covering her feet. So covering the feet during prayers is not necessary.
A must, yeah.
But if there is a non-mahram present, then she must observe. She must cover her feet as well.
Yes.
And let me also, just say that hijab actually is not. According to all religious authorities, and of course, according to what we read in books, hijab is not particular to Islam only. Hijab
yes.
existed even in the pre-Islamic era,
yeah.
and it still exists in some religions and some cultures. Of course, the religions have changed over the period of time. They have been tempered with. And that's why many, Christians and many Jews do not observe hijab, while they are supposed, according to their religion, mm-hmm. to observe hijab.
Yes.
Of course, they have their own words. They don't use the term hijab, but
yes.
we use the term hijab. They all probably use some other words,
yes.
which we have no information about, of course.
Right.
Now, when it comes, there is an important question which many people ask, and that's... whether the Quran, for example, whether there is any verse in the Quran which might clearly refer to it or not.
Yes, let me postpone it to after the break, okay?
Sure.
Thank you very much. I'm really sorry for cut you short. We'll actually reach the break, so let's have a break, and then we'll be back and continue our program on English radio.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are talking about the important subject of hijab with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, before the break, you were referring to a question regarding whether there is a verse in the Holy Quran endorsing hijab, right?
Yeah. Well, as I said, there is an important verse, and of course the most important verse in the Quran about hijab is the verse 31 of chapter An-Nur, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the most important reference for the hijab in the Holy Quran. وَقُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنَاتِ يَغْضُضْنَ مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِنَّ وَيَحْفَظْنَ فُرُوجَهُنَّ وَلَا يُبْدِينَ زِينَتَهُنَّ إِلَّا مَا ظَهَرَ مِنْهَا. Now, this is a lengthy verse, of course.
Yes.
Now, I would like to read the translation. And tell the faithful woman to cast down their looks. يَغْضُضْنَ مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِنَّ وَيَحْفَظْنَ فُرُوجَهُنَّ. And they should guard their private guards. وَلَا يُبْدِينَ زِينَتَهُنَّ. And they should not show their ornaments and their charms, their mm-hmm. beautification and so on.
They should not be ostentatious or showy.
Yeah, showy, of course. And, of course... إِلَّا مَا ظَهَرَ مِنْهَا beyond what is acceptably visible, because there are some parts of the women's body which mm-hmm. are visible, and they mm-hmm. cannot cover them because yes. they have to live in the society. They should move and interact with other people.
Like the face that you said.
Sure. And then let them draw their scarves over their bosoms, you know. وَلِيَضْرِبْنَ بِخُمُورِهِنَّ عَلَى جَيْبِهِنَّ This is the most important part of the verse. Let them draw their scarves over their bosoms. And this means that the scarf at least is a must. And when the scarf, when a woman is wears a scarf, that the scarf should be long enough to cover the woman's bosom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's very
important. In other
words,
the chest area.
The chest area,
or the breast area.
And this is one. This is one of the verses in the Quran. Of course, there are numerous traditions about hijab, based on which the scholars, the ulama, the religious authorities have derived and deduced Islamic laws, and given their fatwa.
Uh-huh, I see. We have a very, very short time till the end of this program or this episode of Islamic Laws. Sheikh, would you be kind enough actually to talk about the special way or method that hijab should be observed according to the Islamic dress code? Because you also mentioned that in the other religions, they also have some kind of dress code, whether they practice it today or not, that's another story, right?
Yeah, sure.
So would you?
Yeah, of course. A woman must cover her head, hair, and body, as we said, except for the face, hands, from the gaze of strangers.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about strangers, we are not talking about, about close relatives. They are not strangers.
Mm-hmm.
Those men that are marriageable, they are called strangers according to Islamic Sharia.
Right.
And another word for strangers is, non-mahram men. So men, a woman should cover these parts of her body from a non-mahram man or from non-mahram people. And of course, she must not show her adornments and her makeup, her beautification, her ornaments. For example, if she is wearing gold bangles or bracelets or rings, gold rings, these are ornaments.
Yes.
And these are things that must be covered by the woman. The same is the case with the makeup. If she is wearing makeup, if she is wearing, for example, eyelash extension.
Right.
These are beautifications. These are adornments,
mm-hmm.
and these are things that, of course, must be covered. So there is not a special method. Okay.
Right.
Every nation, every culture might have its own method of hijab, its own
method
modest
of
clothing.
Yes.
Modest clothing.
Yes.
Of course, Iranians have their own chador, their yes. veils, and Indians have their own.
Lebanese have their dough.
Sure.
Yeah.
Lebanese have their own bushiers, and they call it bushia, I suppose. And that's, even they cover their faces.
Right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you for listening to this program of Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me and the rest of the crew. We say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent.
and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran.
You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.